Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
At the direction of the President of the United States, fighter aircraft assigned to U.S. Northern Command successfully took down a high-altitude airborne object.
Less than a week after the Chinese balloon, today an object was shot down over Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a number of Toyo heat stoves failed during a cold snap in December, and nobody quite knows why.
I know how to fix it, but exactly what caused it, I'm still not sure.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Time with friends means the world for kids, and the same goes for kids at heart. Connecting with friends and loved ones matters because Alaskans are better together. Boost your power to protect yourself and those around you by keeping up to date on all recommended vaccines, including an annual flu shot, or any boosters recommended by your provider. Visit vaccinate.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
F-22 fighter jets out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson shot down an airborne object this morning off the northern coast of Alaska. Military personnel are now working to recover debris from the object that fell onto some pack ice in an area of the Beaufort Sea. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The U.S. Northern Command scrambled the F-22s, which shot down the object at around 9:30 a.m.,
at the direction of the President of the United States, fighter aircraft assigned to U.S. Northern Command successfully took down a high-altitude airborne object off the northern coast of Alaska at 1:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time today within U.S. sovereign airspace over U.S. territorial water.
Air Force Brigadier General Patrick Ryder said in a news conference this afternoon that North American Aerospace Defense Command ground radar detected the object late Thursday night and began tracking it. He said when the fighter pilots arrived, they checked it out and, after being authorized, shot down the object with a Sidewinder air-to-air missile.
The object was flying at an altitude of 40,000 feet and posed a reasonable threat to the safety of civilian flight.
Ryder said the Northern Command has sent aircraft from the Alaskan Command and Alaskan Air National Guard to survey an area where debris from the object fell after it was shot down. Those include an HC-130 search and rescue plane and 2 helicopters, an HH-60 Blackhawk and CH-47 Chinook. And the Federal Aviation Administration designated a temporary flight restriction around the site, which closes the airspace to all unpermitted aircraft.
The object was about the size of a small car, so not similar in size or shape to the high-altitude surveillance balloon that was taken down off the coast of South Carolina on February 4.
Members of the press at the news conference pressed Ryder repeatedly on why the military was quick to shoot down the object today, but allowed the Chinese surveillance balloon to fly over Alaska and the lower 48 for days before it was finally shot down Sunday off the East Coast. But Ryder answered repeatedly, reiterating that this object threatened civilian aviation, which flies up to about 45,000 feet, but the Chinese balloon mostly stayed at or above 60,000 feet. But Senator Lisa Murkowski also questioned the rationale.
Somehow or other, Brett had gotten to a point where it was good to take down on the East Coast, but for some reason, we didn't want to take it down up in the north.
Murkowski said in the video statement she posted this afternoon that the different responses taken by the military could convince the Chinese that they can get away with spying on Alaska.
It sends a message to China that if you want to send something to surveil a part of the United States of America, Alaska's your place. That's not the message to send.
Senator said today's incursion should remind Americans of Alaska's role in national defense.
I say it time and time again, Alaska is on the front lines of defense for the United States of America.
Governor Mike Dunleavy issued a similar statement late this afternoon. He said, quote, because of our close proximity to our neighbors, there's very little margin for error. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Toyo stoves from the Japanese brand Toyotomi are a popular heating system across Alaska, especially in rural areas. They burn efficiently on stove oil, heating cabins and houses in places where temperatures regularly drop way below zero. But stove technicians say Toyo's mid-sized stoves are failing in cold weather, and there's no consensus about why it's happening. KTOO's Anna Canny reports.
David Quinsenberry swears by his Toyo stove. He's used it to heat his home in Juneau for nearly a decade, and he says that it rarely malfunctions. But that changed during a cold snap in December.
We had single-digit temperatures, and my stove went out. I had my niece was staying here, and she called and said there's a code on it. The code shows that it's not getting any fuel.
Luckily, he had a backup heater to keep the house from freezing up. But the stove was nearly brand new, a Toyo Laser 531-532. He'd installed it in August to replace his old stove, a larger Toyo model that had run for 8 winters. When the newer one stopped working, Quinsenberry called local stove technician Steve Sanders to take a look.
And he knew exactly what the problem was. He opened the stove up, and the fuel nozzle was all carboned up with black crud. And he showed me photographs of other stoves, and mine looked exactly like that.
Sanders owns S&S Toyo Repair. It's the only Toyo repair shop in Juneau. He says he serviced around 20 stoves back in December, and they all had the same issue. A black ring of carbon buildup that was snuffing out the burner flame.
It was quite a few of them that did it around the exact same time. It was when doing that cold snap.
All of those stoves were in Toyo's mid-size range. Most of them were less than a year old. The majority were Toyo 531-532s, along with a handful of OM23s. That's the predecessor to the 530 series. The two models use most of the same technology. Sanders says he's seen similar carbon buildup before when people use additives in their fuel.
But not new heaters and not this many at one time. No, I've never seen it.
The stove is able to run again when the carbon buildup is scrubbed away. And all of the Juneau stoves were covered by warranty. But Sanders says he's still scratching his head about the root cause of the outage.
I know how to fix it, but exactly what caused it, I'm still not sure.
He believes it could have been a problem with a bad batch of fuel. But he's waiting on answers from Rural Energy Enterprises in Anchorage. They're the state's sole distributor of Toyo stoves. Rural Energy told KTOO that any potential fuel studies would be conducted privately. With warmer weather recently, the stoves Sanders cleaned up have been running just fine. But technicians in colder parts of the state have had the same problem.
They will shut down. I mean, brand new ones right out of the box. And we've been dealing with this for a good 2 years now.
James Altum, a technician from Arctic Technical Services in Fairbanks, says he believes the problem is not the fuel, but the way that this model of Toyo stove processes fuel. Altum says that most of the Laser 530 units they've installed malfunction.
And it really happens when it gets cold. And my boss and I have investigated it, and we think it has something to do with cold fuel and cold air.
The problem is, they don't know for sure. Altum says that local technicians don't have a deep knowledge about the Toyo stove's manufacturing or programming, which makes it difficult to find a long-term solution. He says Rural Energy hasn't had any answers for him either. Like Sanders, he's been told the problem is related to fuel supplies, but he's skeptical. He says he serviced Toyo stoves across Fairbanks and Barrow that use fuel from several different companies. The one thing they have in common is the kind of unit.
It is strictly the 530 series unit that is having the issue.
Rural Energy told KTOO that they don't believe there is a widespread issue with any of the Toyo stoves they distribute. But without an explanation for the malfunction, Altum and Arctic Technical Services have few options to respond to unhappy customers. He says they've tried to steer new customers away from the 530 series altogether.
People that come in to buy them, I really try to talk them out of it, because until they fix this problem, you know, I don't like to sell product that I can't stand behind.
Toyo stove owners will have to wait for the next cold snap to see if their stoves hold up. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
A bill adding criminal penalties for harassing 911 dispatchers or abusing the 911 system in Alaska is advancing closer to a vote in the state Senate after the legislature failed to pass it last year. The Alaska Beacon reports that the bill from Republican Senator David Wilson would make threatening a 911 dispatcher a Class B misdemeanor. Repeatedly calling 911 after being asked to stop would also be a misdemeanor. The legislation was inspired in part by an incident in which one person called 911 more than 85 times in an 8-hour period during the 4th of July holiday. 23 states have similar laws on the books, and Wilson's proposal passed the Senate last year but failed to pass the House before the end of the 32nd legislature. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, business is blooming for flower shops ahead of their busiest day of the year.
We'll just design all day, and then I'll come in and probably start working back at like 8 tonight and work all night.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Time with friends means the world for kids, and the same goes for kids at heart. Connecting with friends and loved ones matters because Alaskans are better together. Boost your power to protect yourself and those around you by keeping up to date on all recommended vaccines, including an annual flu shot, or any boosters recommended by your provider. Visit vaccinate.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Alaska state troopers arrested a 47-year-old Selawik man this week in the death of a resident whose body was found in a tote at a local dump. Troopers say 41-year-old Timothy Snyder's body was found late Wednesday. Investigators responded to the community of Selawik about 90 miles east of Kotzebue the next day. According to troopers, an investigation found that 47-year-old Lance Bricky shot Snyder to death in a local home on Wednesday. Bricky was arrested on murder, weapons misconduct, and evidence tampering charges. Snyder's body was sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage. His family has been notified. A man's death at a Wasilla home this week is believed to be a case of carbon monoxide poisoning. Alaska state troopers responded to the home just before 8 p.m. Wednesday. Medics tried to perform CPR on 50-year-old Chad Grasmick, but he died at the scene. Troopers say high carbon monoxide levels were found in the home. A living area inside an attic space had both a gas generator and a propane heater running without ventilation. Colorless, odorless carbon monoxide can build up in enclosed spaces and suffocate people when fuel-burning equipment is run indoors. The gas often kills people in winter when they're trying to heat their homes. In November, two people died and a third was sickened in a North Pole workshop. Responders found a generator and a still-warm wood stove. Grasmick's family has been notified. His body was taken to the state medical examiner's office. There's no end in sight for the school bus driver strike in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District. The union representing the drivers is accusing the company that employs them, Durham School Services, of canceling meetings to negotiate a contract and refusing to address safety concerns. The strike, which started January 31st, has tangled student transportation. Most students in the Matsu School District don't have bus service now for nearly 2 weeks. Patrick Fitzgerald, a spokesman with Teamsters Local 959, says the union made an offer to Durham during negotiations yesterday. He says the offer was rejected and Durham officials left the meeting early. Fitzgerald says the union and its drivers are eager to end the strike.
However, they're not going to do it for wages that are far outmatched by neighboring communities like Fairbanks and Anchorage. We're looking for equity here.
Officials with Durham's parent company, Illinois-based National Express, did not respond to requests for comment. Teamsters 959 announced this morning that they'd filed several unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board against Durham. One claim is that Durham canceled multiple negotiation meetings, delaying the process. Matsu Borough School District spokeswoman Jillian Morrissey says the strike may be impacting attendance.
We are noticing a small bump in absenteeism, but that could be due to the bus strike, that could be sickness, that could be, pre-scheduled absences for students. So we just need a little more time to look into the absenteeism.
She adds that the district encourages both the union and Durham to return to the bargaining table. Fitzgerald says, as of today, Durham has not issued a time to reschedule negotiations. Well, on a tiny remote island in southeast Alaska, scientists recently made a surprising discovery. Wolves are eating sea otters. And not just one every so often. For this pack, it's the wolves' main source of food. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning has this story on a study that's making waves in the scientific community.
Pleasant Island is located about a mile south of the mainland near the town of Gustavus. Historically, wolves would occasionally swim over, but had never colonized the island until about a decade ago.
This pack of wolves really defied all of our predictions.
Gretchen Roffler has studied wolves in Southeast for 8 years, and she's the lead author of a study published in January on the island's wolves. This new pack killed all the black-tailed deer on the island, a favorite meal for Southeast wolves. They're a territorial species, and an established pack was back on the mainland, preventing a return. Roffler and other scientists assumed they would die off from starvation.
But instead, what we found was that the wolves stayed on the island, and they continued to reproduce annually.
But how? The island is small, just over 20 square miles. What were the wolves eating? Nearby residents in Gustavus noticed new wolf activity on the island where they would hunt deer and pick berries. Greg Streveler is one of them, and his first thought was,
uh-oh.
Streveler is a retired ecologist with the National Park Service and has studied the area's land and animals for over 50 years.
The uh-oh was, you could see what's coming. Having the pack discovered the place and there was two wolves instead of one, you could kind of read the tea leaves, you know.
Within a few years, Streveler and other residents saw the island's deer disappear. So the scientists stepped in and began to gather data. In 2015, they counted 3 wolves. A year later, there were 10. By 2017, 13.
The wolf densities on this island at this time were some of the highest ever recorded.
Roffler's team collected scat and studied it in the lab. And it showed something surprising. Sea otter.
And at first I thought, well, this is maybe just a blip. Maybe this is just an occasional thing that wolves are able to do.
So they collected wolf hair. While scat shows what wolves have eaten recently, hair gives scientists a longer look. And tests on the hair proved it wasn't a blip. The wolves were eating lots of sea otters and had been for a while. Roffler says it underscores how adaptable they are.
Something that we assume about wolves is that they really can't live without ungulate prey. They very quickly switched to a diet that primarily consists of sea otters. It really just took a couple years for that to happen.
Roffler hasn't witnessed the pack hunt and is hesitant to speculate about it, but Shreveler has a theory.
The wolves are not dealing with a healthy group of otters. So I don't think it's a big deal for wolves to find some.
He says otters in the area might be weak and are hauling out on land more than normal. Sea otters were introduced to the region in the 1960s after being hunted to near extinction. Streveler says it's possible that there are more otters in the area than the habitat can support.
Before, nobody here ever saw an otter haul out, ever. And so to find a naive group of very easy to catch, very, very delicious critters, Oh my God, you know, it's like discovering the Garden of Eden.
Scientists don't know how this unusual diet might affect wolves in the long term. They also don't know how long the food source will be around. But Streveler thinks it's temporary.
The sea otter wolf thing is probably a flash in the pan. It's not likely there's going to be both a lot of sea otters and a lot of weak sea otters available very long. It's a very, very brief opportunistic window.
Reporting for Coast Alaska in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The 2023 Yukon Quest Alaska 550 Sled Dog Race wrapped up yesterday. A day after Brent Sass won and Amanda Otto took second, the remaining 6 mushers jockeyed for place and prize money over the last 50-plus miles from Nenana to the finish line in Fairbanks. KUAC's Lex Trinan reports.
Teams rolled into the finish at the Tina Pump House through the early hours of the morning on Thursday as temperatures dropped to negative double digits. Around 5 a.m., Cody Straith's team charged into the finish chute to claim fourth place in the 550-mile quest. He's bundled up in a windproof parka lined with a fur ruff and eyeglasses covered in thick frost. He steps off his sled and a handler passes him a phone with a video call from his wife, fellow musher Paige Drobny.
Hi baby, you look great!
Batman in a little bit.
While temperatures during the first part of the race were moderate, they dropped to negative double digits during the last long run on the Tanana and Chena Rivers late Wednesday and into Thursday. Straith says it was a tough, cold run as he tried to avoid being detected by his competitors by turning off his headlamp.
Ran all the way here in the dark because I thought Wade would, maybe I'd be able to catch Wade, and I thought maybe I'd get caught by someone behind me. So.
Wade Mars, the team in front of him, had finished 2 hours earlier thanks to running shoes that Mars had put on in the last checkpoint in Nanana. Mars jogged alongside his sled during the 50-mile run as much as he could. The teams behind Straith were engaged in their own battle for the last bit of the prize payout for fifth place, a cool $5,000. Big Lake musher Nick Petit bested Fairbanks' Riley Dyke to snag fifth place, about an hour behind Straith. Petit, running his first quest, reluctantly agrees to an interview.
Sure.
2 minutes?
I gotta pee, but we can answer a couple.
He's dressed in a billowy white windbreaker top and bottom over his parka. He says the river run from Nanana to Fairbanks was cold, and he also had a more unusual problem from the night before.
I slept too much.
He says his dogs were tired from navigating Eagle and Rosebud summits twice this year. By the time the dogs got to the Tanana River on Wednesday evening, they just weren't feeling it. He had to stop once to camp on the river, and then a second time, allowing mushers from behind him, like Amanda Otto and Cody Straith, to pass him.
Oh, you never like being passed. I mean, even if you're driving your car.
Still, Petit says, he might be back next year, gunning for a bigger share of the prize purse.
Yeah, got it.
Riley Dyke arrives about 15 minutes later. Like Petit and several other teams, he says he struggled on the last 150 miles of river running on the Tanana. After resting in Nanana 50 miles from the finish, he hopscotched with Petit's team several times.
Almost chased Nick down, or chased him down for a minute until he did his usual tricks.
Still, Dyke says he enjoyed the race, even with a broken foot pad that cost him a few hours in Central. He says the 550 distance is great training for his upcoming 1,000-mile Iditarod run.
You know, it's a distance race. The dogs have a metabolic change as far as how they absorb nutrition and things the same way they do in a 1,000-mile race. About day three, they shift how they metabolize fats and things, so their appetites go up and increase, and it's really cool to see that.
Just before 11 o'clock on Thursday, 8th place finisher Shaney Traska pulls in with 9 dogs to close out this year's quest.
Red Lantern, it's my very first one, so that's exciting.
All teams finished within about 15 hours after 5 days of racing. One team was withdrawn from the race about 300 miles in because it had fallen too far behind in the eyes of the race marshal. Traska, a 2019 Iditarod finisher, says it was a competitive race.
I thought I went into it with a somewhat conservative resting schedule, but something that wouldn't put me way far behind, and I guess it did because everybody else was just flying out there. It was pretty impressive.
Reporting from the finish of the Yukon Quest in Fairbanks, I'm Lex Trinan.
Valentine's Day is around the corner, and for people in the business of romance, it's crunch time. KDLL's Sabine Pooks spoke with one florist in Soldotna as she gears up for one of the busiest times of the year and has this story.
A person's nose can build up a certain immunity to flowers over time. Chandra Rose Flower Shop in Soldotna is lush with the smell of roses and ranunculus, but shop owner Dacia Cunningham is too used to the smell to notice. And frankly, she's too busy.
So today is like the start of our It's time to bust out arrangements.
Valentine's Day is just a few days away. In the floral business, that means it's time to buckle down.
We will just design all day, and then I'll come in and probably start working back at like 8 tonight and work all night, and then go to sleep for a little bit, and they'll come in Super Bowl week. This is our Super Bowl.
Tundra Rose designs floral arrangements for weddings and other events, as well as holidays like Valentine's Day and Mother's Day. Her arrangements start at $50 and go up from there. Cunningham says she's the only brick-and-mortar independent flower shop on the Kenai Peninsula, and she says there was a learning curve when she was first starting her business 3 years ago. She grew up in Soldotna and came to the floral industry through weddings.
So I started with wedding planning. I did wedding flowers for one of my brides and liked it more than planning. And so it slowly evolved into that is what I just specialized in and come a long way. I look back at my old arrangements and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, ooh.
In 2020, Cunningham signed her first lease. Today, she's in a small storefront in Soldotna, just enough room for a counter framed by shelves of vases and coolers of bouquets. This time of year, most of her flowers come from wholesalers in Anchorage and LA, who she says source from all over the world. That can be a challenge since the flowers don't always come so fresh. Plus, she says they can sometimes freeze in transit, an added thorn to an already difficult process.
So once we get our boxes in, they come and we have to give them a fresh cut, and then we use a hydrating solution because they've been out of water for sometimes 24 hours by the time we get them.
They cut the stems, put them in buckets of clean, fresh water, and then they start designing. Cunningham says she didn't used to think of herself as a creative person, but she loves creating arrangements, making decisions about what kind of flowers to pair together to create bouquets that are full and bright. She says what she likes about flowers is that they're cheerful, especially around Valentine's Day. They can be such a contrast to the grayness
of
winter.
That was one of the things with like the retail side. I started with weddings where it's so happy that then we started doing like sympathy arrangements, which is definitely a big part of the business. A lot of the times when people send flowers, it's as a get well or something that's more somber. So that's one of the things that even if it's sympathy, we try to make it like cheerful. So if it's going to someone that's sad, that it, you know, brightens their day a little bit.
She says her biggest holiday is Mother's Day. And they'll sometimes get orders for unconventional occasions too, like dog birthdays or St. Patrick's Day. But in the days leading up to Valentine's Day, there's not much time to think about anything else. Cunningham says a lot of buyers come to her pretty late in the game for flowers.
So we will get most of our orders like Monday, the day before.
Still, she says time is of the essence.
Like, we do get to the point where the phone rings so much that we like can't answer them quickly enough. And then sometimes at holidays it comes to where we just have to turn the phone off because we're either sold out or we just can't keep up with people walking in the door and the calls.
And she says a good rule of thumb is just to pick up the phone and order now. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Anna Canny in Juneau, Chris Clint and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Lex Trinan in Fairbanks, and Sabine Pooks in Soldotna. If you want to send us a news tip, question, comment, a Valentine's Day card, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert. Madeline Rose is our producer. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Time with friends means the world for kids, and the same goes for kids at heart. Connecting with friends and loved ones matters because Alaskans are better together. Boost your power to protect yourself and those around you by keeping up to date on all recommended vaccines, including an annual flu shot, or any boosters recommended by your provider. Visit vaccinate.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.